Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to the Top Order podcast. Here was us hoping we'd be talking about end of series between England and India, but alas, not to be. Following the Twitter sphere leading up to the game, we're all pretty disappointed not to see that Old Trafford test go ahead on Jimmy Anderson's home ground. We've still got plenty to talk about on the podcast, though. Of course, covering the England-India aftermath, Australia-Afghanistan, Black Caps and Bangladesh wrap-up, and a whole heap of stuff around T20 and the restart at the IPL. All coming up on the Top Order podcast after the swish. Well, guys, plenty of cricket going on around the world still, and a lot of it for our viewing pleasure over the course of the last week. But the one thing we have missed is that final fifth test match between India and England, due to be played at the Emirates Old Trafford. A lot of disappointed fans who would have forked out for train tickets, hotels, bacon sandwich on the way to the ground, couple of beers, early doors in their local Wetherspoons. And then they get to the ground and unable to see any play because it's been called off. Lots and lots of press around this, lots and lots of different views on the reasons. And we're still a little bit unclear as to even how this affects the World Test Championship. With at the moment the game being cancelled as opposed to postponed. I'm sure we'll unpick all of that as we go. But your guys' thoughts first and foremost as we sit here recording on this Monday in lockdown here in Auckland?
Well, as a cricket fan, it's incredibly disappointing not to see a conclusion to that test series that was poised, you know, for a reasonably exciting finale. At the Old Trafford, of course, a good ground for England to play on. They played bubble cricket there last year, and that's really the irony, is that we were managed to get grounds in far more difficult conditions last year in terms of biosecure bubbles, but weren't able to get them going again this time around. So a massive disappointment for us as fans, but I guess you have to take what India have said at face value, in that they didn't feel safe or comfortable playing, and you have to take what they've said at face value, I think. And certainly Sourav Ganguly has had a lot to say to the Crick Info Press today, and we can cover that as well if you want to.
Do we have to take what India says at face value? Because I think that's probably the thing that has upset a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people, you know, immediately just go, oh, this is down to the IPL, and everyone just wants to get back to the IPL. They never wanted to play this game. I suppose we're never really going to know. But, I mean, what do you guys make of that kind of claim?
Yeah, well, look, I'm happy to jump in if no one else is going to. Look, I think it's a really difficult one because you've got some differing views. I think what was odd to me is in the immediate aftermath. And look, you can only imagine what's going on behind the scenes in all of this, right? So if you believe all the conspiracy theories, the Indian team was seen out and about in and around Manchester on Thursday. They didn't train on the day before the game, which if you don't train on the day before the game, typically probably means you weren't intending to rock up and play in the fixture, would be my take on it. But then there's a counterpoint. I think then Tom Harrison was obviously behind the scenes with his counterparts at the BCCI trying to figure out what the communication was. And I think it was all coming out really quite quickly. And there was a retraction almost immediately after they'd said that the series had been forfeited. Then it wasn't forfeited. And then Tom Harrison made a comment that said, this is absolutely nothing to do with the IPL. But when you kind of do the math, I think it's got everything to do with the IPL. And I say that without any blame or anything that I'm going to level on the players. I personally blame the cricket boards here. We knew that India thought it was pretty tight coming into this series and to get the amount of cricket into this English summer as they needed to and still get back safely and to complete the IPL. So it's a delicate balance, I think, between that TV revenue and the players operating under these increasingly stressed environments. And I guess when we look back at it logically, to be honest, expecting a 5-test series to A, be reasonable to put the players through that, and B, even be completed in a country where I think last week there was 38,000 cases per day on average in the UK. It's pretty freaking ludicrous to think that that was going to be completed. But I, on the counterpoint, don't buy the line that that's got nothing to do with the IPL. If any of those players had tested positive, they would have had to stay in the UK for at least 10 days, meaning they missed the start of the IPL tournament. And look, I think that, you know, they're off to their, you know, bubbles with their teams where we know they're tremendously well looked after for their franchises. And, you know, protecting to an extent the payday. I don't necessarily think it's about the money. I think it's more about the convenience piece and the fact that a lot of these guys have now got young families that travel with them as well. So I don't blame the players one bit, but I think the boards could have probably had a bit more of an honest conversation a little bit earlier on and said, do you know what? We can't really squeeze 5 tests into this summer and still get the IPL in. Something's got to give and it's going to need to be a test match. And that's the reality, I think, of the way that cricket's going to be played over the course of the next 12 months as this virus still affects world cricket. But yeah, that's my rant over.
Yeah, for me, I actually, interestingly, I agree with Binksy on that to some extent.
We're back after the swish.
I think if you trace that back to, Ravi Shastri's book event, where this is all, it's been the catalyst for this whole thing. The major thing that's changed between then and now is that due to this COVID outbreak and the, you know, COVID breaking the bubble or the what's it called, the living arrangements, the managed living arrangements that they're living in, was that a 6-day quarantine would need to be held in the UAE. Whereas prior to that, it was going to be a bubble-to-bubble transfer, no quarantine required. So I think that that's the main thing that I can see that's changed. And we did ask this question earlier when we talked about the IPL coming about. Can the IPL hold itself up with their domestic players who aren't their franchise players? And I think we've found the answer to that. I think that we've found out that no, they're not willing to take that risk. And that's essentially what's happened here, I believe. I don't think that we can go down the line of bubble fatigue and things like that in this instance. But conversely to that, I think that the reaction also has been a little bit poor, I feel like. I think that everybody was ready to be quite aggressive about this pullout of the series. And at the end of the day, like Binksy said, this has been a massively long tour for the Indian players. They turned up a month before the first test started. And then prior to that, we're quarantining in India before coming to England. So, yeah, I think in this day and age, how people tour needs to be looked at going forward.
Yeah, well, can I just pick up on that and say, I feel like the warning signs have been there that something like this was going to happen. I mean, we've seen players put, you know, I think we said originally when we were first talking about the IPL, I think you said it, Raj, that players are going to talk with their feet. You know, they're going to go to these tournaments if they want to go to the tournaments. And we're suddenly starting to see players say, no, I don't want to go to that tournament. and, you know, they're making themselves unavailable for international duty. Like, is this actually sustainable? Is there just too much cricket now in this changed environment? Maybe there was too much cricket beforehand.
Well, I think having three IPLs run in the period of 12 months has certainly put a strain on scheduling. And I think boards have tried to do the best they can both to fit in the mandated schedules around the World Test Championship and also the one-day Super Series that's now being played for qualification for the World Cup, for the 50-over World Cup, and also to try to prepare the sides as best they can for T20 World Cup, while also allowing those players to go and play in the big four domestic tournaments, in the IPL, the Big Bash, the 100 in this case, or the Vitality Blast in England, and also, you know, whichever you prefer as your T20 domestic league of choice, either the CPL or the Pakistan Super League. So with all of those tournaments going on, it's always going to be difficult for players to try and figure out the right balance of touring life and also earning an income from playing cricket. You know, Sourav Ganguly came out today and said the players refuse to play, but you can't blame them. You know, the physio being such a close contact of the players, the only one available, mixing freely with the players and performing their tests and giving them massages. They were devastated when he tested positive. So, you know, there's a fair amount of emotional toil that these players are going under living in that bubble. And, you know, Ganguly goes to speak on it at length. But the players are having to, as you say, Stuart, make some really, really tough decisions around which tournaments they play in. And I can't see it changing with the way that the ICC has scheduled international cricket with at least one, if not two, major tournaments every year. When you think about the World Test Championship every 2 years, then you've got the Champions Trophy coming back and World Cups in 50-over and T20 cricket. There's just going to be no relenting on the schedule of cricket between now and 2031, which is when they've locked in that schedule for. So, look, something is going to have to give at some point.
I've got an interesting question to the panel here. Is this a forfeit?
Who know? I have no idea because you don't know the situation. I think that's it's going to be a really tough situation for the IPL for the ICC to kind of determine. They're the ones that are going to hopefully get the truth, right? I mean, look, if like Baldy says, if this physio had tested positive in enough time and every single player has been a close contact of that physio, they've all had work on them, then I feel like, you know, the way Delta's being talked about and the way it's spread around communities, I think it's a no-brainer that they would be worried that there was going to be a positive test. The fact that there has been no positive test so far, who knows? You know, there's been talk of, you know, players vaccinated. Does that matter? I really don't know. And I think it's really tough to kind of try and answer that. I would love to know because I actually have a bet on the series of India winning that series and it still hasn't actually paid out. And I would like that to happen at some point. But I don't feel confident enough to answer that.
Look, I'm sure someone will correct me, but I think in the immediate aftermath, I think one of the big things is around the insurance payout that the ECB would have got versus a cancellation versus a forfeiture. And then I think needing some clarity around the way that the rules were written by the ICC for a COVID cancellation specifically. Mm. And the fact that no players have tested positive prior to that, it's going to test their decision-making ability. I don't think it's going to come down to the ICC making that call. I think it's going to come down to the conversations between the BCCI and the ECB as to what can be tabled as a potential, I suppose, reparations is the wrong word, but, you know, how do they potentially redo this test match? There's talk of actually them tacking a couple of 2020s onto their white ball tour to England next summer as compensation to Old Trafford, so they would get to host both of those T20s. But even, you know, even with a sold out 6 hours worth of, you know, beer fueled cricket in a T20 arena, I don't think that they're going to net the same amount of cash as they would through corporate hospitality and the venue being open for even 4 days of a test match. So I'm not sure that that's going to be the case. Someone asked the question, do we care? And I think this World Test Championship probably now makes us care more. And that's an odd feeling, because we didn't think that at the start of the World Test Championship a couple of years ago. But all of a sudden now, I actually really care whether this is a tied series or not, because, you know, it could make a bit of an intrinsic difference at the end of that period. The final point I'll just make in closing is, we are living in this, it's been said a whole bunch of times, and if you're playing COVID bingo, unprecedented times, team of 5 million, be kind, go hard, go early, all these kind of things, you know, are rolled out ad infinitum now. But the biggest thing for me is we've got to look at the choice of the player in all of this now. And just like, you know, on this call, some of us prefer Burger King over McDonald's, and some of us would prefer the Postman's Leg over the Dark Horse for our quiz venue, for example. And some players are going to, and that's a very niche reference to our New Zealand and Auckland listeners, but there's going to be players that actually prefer to be available for the IPL than for a test match. And I think we've got to actually just look at the fact that, unfortunately, the ICC is a pretty toothless governing body when it comes to the power of scheduling stuff over something else. It is going to be where the broadcast deal, the revenue flows, as to what's going to be prioritised by TV companies and the players as well, ultimately. And maybe for us sitting here as, you know, late 30, early 40-year-old blokes who have always had test cricket as the pinnacle of our part of the game, maybe we've got to realise that this is a little bit like probably the guys felt back in World Series cricket, where, you know, the coloured pyjamas came out, they started playing soccer grounds, and it was all a bit of a farce. But, you know, look where that's landed us now. And, you know, maybe this is just our generation's version of that World Series cricket in terms of player power.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I remember we asked a lot of questions around the time when cricket was getting back underway. You know, what's going to happen if there is a COVID positive test in the middle of a test match, for example? What we have to be careful of here is that this has massive impacts on a lot of cricketers, a lot of journalists, a lot of administrators throughout the game. Like if you have a look at South Africa, just in the last year and a bit, they've had Australia pull out of a tour. They've had England half complete a tour. All of this stuff costs a lot of money to that Cricket South Africa board, who was already in turmoil at the time. But I feel like now, because England and India, who are superpowers, are involved, this has all of a sudden had the spotlight put on it, even though it's a problem that was always there. And the regulations that were put in place were put in place so loosely that it gives them a little bit of wiggle room here, in terms that the ICC now need to determine what this series is going to be classed as, whether it is a forfeiture, so the series is equal, or it's going to be a cancellation / postponement to stay at 2-1. I just think it's very interesting that this is the place where we've ended up in, and it's going to be interesting to see what the actual outcome is that the ICC determine.
I just picking up on that, to basically say, I really feel like the next 6 to 12 months of cricket, and international cricket in particular, is going to be really, really crucial, because, like you guys have said, this stuff is not going away. And if it continues down this line, then, you know, we've already talked about Ashes players withdrawing. We're talking about all these players it seems like it's too much for these players. And like you say, the boards are losing money. You know, the way that the fans were treated in this case, I think, is pretty poor. That, you know, I think that they knew probably that the game was not going to be played, or at least there was a chance that it was not going to be played. I think that all sort of that stuff could have come out a bit earlier. And people are going to start getting pretty frustrated if this stuff isn't sorted out in the next 6 to 12 months. And I don't know whose job it is. It's probably the ICC's job. But like you say, they've never really been an interventionalist kind of organisation that comes in and sorts things out. So, look, yeah, it's fascinating what's going to happen in the next few months.
Mm. Yeah, just before we wrap up, I guess a couple of things to take away for me. The ICC does have a decision to make, because according to Tom Harrison's press release, they've asked the ICC to have formally adjudicated on the result of that, as per 2 days ago, George De Bell on the Crick Info Press. And Sourav Ganguly has come out today and said that they are happy to play a one-off test as a one-off test rather than as a conclusion to this series. So, you know, there's lots still to kind of nut out in the next sort of 2 or 3 days. But, you know, ICC have kind of made
their
own...
That's a forfeiture then, if they're happy to call the series off at this point because they're 2-1 up and play another test just to satisfy the revenue piece. That's saying to me that's a forfeiture and we'll play another test. Yeah, sorry to cut across you, but that's probably my take on that statement, to be fair.
Yeah, it's going to be really tough to unravel all of these kind of backroom negotiations that are going on day and night between the BCCI and the ECB and also probably the ICC as well at this point. So we know that Tom Harrison and Sourav Ganguly and their respective boards were talking well through the night Thursday and Friday to try and nut this out. They've asked the ICC to adjudicate. The ICC has set the international major tournament schedule. So they're the ones that have kind of set that in place. They've allowed windows for these professional tournaments. So they are in a position where they can make that decision. My concern is whether or not they will be able to satisfy all the relevant organizing committees of those major domestic tournaments and keep a schedule that allows us to see international cricket with meaning, both at the test level and also, you know, a little bit of white ball cricket as well.
Before we move, kind of give it the swish and move away from this series, let's talk a little bit about the cricket and kind of, you know, some brief points, I suppose, on, you know, what actually happened. I know we've unpacked it all a lot, but I guess I have two thoughts. First one is just Rohit Sharma and how impressive he was. I know we touched on that a lot last week and you know, you can go back and listen. All of that stuff still applies. And like, I think Binksy might have said it, Raj might have said it, that he's really turned himself into an all-format player and one of the best going around. And I've been very, very impressed with what he's done in the UK, considering that's been such a challenge for him at the moment. The other thing I wanted to throw back on you guys in terms of England, and I really feel like, I don't know when it was, maybe after that India series in India, when the... You know, let's say a year ago when all of this kind of core of young English players was picked, we had, you know, the likes of Sibley, Burns, Crawley, Pope, Lawrence, all those guys. And we were going, well, look, you know, England, you could probably even throw Sam Curran in there, that England have got this core of players that they're looking to build and they're looking to create. I would say you look back at that now and say that's bit of a failure. You know, it hasn't really worked. I don't know where the failure is, whether it's on talent identification, whether it's on development of talent, but there's not a lot of those guys that are left. And if you'd gone to those selectors and said, look, we're going to pick all of these guys, we're going to give them 6 months, we're going to give them a year to run, and then we're going to come to this fourth and fifth test of this big series that we've got at home here, and we're going to be back to David Malan and Johnny Bairstow in our middle order, I think they would have been pretty disappointed.
Yeah, I guess I can take the England piece of that. For me, look, I don't necessarily think it's about talent ID. I think what it is about is county cricket being pushed to the margins of the English season and there not being the same A program or Lions program in place to give the guys that need to come through plenty of time to play in those kind of environments and really learn their craft. I think if you look at why England was successful, and look, we get judged a little bit, or England certainly judged themselves on success in the Ashes and then success overseas in India. So if you look at 2010-2011, where we went down under and won the Ashes away from home for the first time in a long, long time. And then a series win in India in 2012 with, you know, similar-ish personnel. The common factor there was England had copied the Australian academy system for, 6 or 7 years in the lead-up to that and got a lot of those guys playing four-day cricket against quality oppositions, shadow squads, following when they went on overseas tours. That's not the case anymore because there just isn't the time. And you've got Johnny Bairstow getting called up back into the test side, arriving at Loughborough in the middle of the night so that he can have a couple of hits against a red ball the next day before he goes off on test match duty. that isn't the preparation that's required. So yeah, the ID piece I don't think is the issue. I think it's the build up piece. But to echo your points, Rohit Sharma, absolute legend, and as we said last week, India just by far the better side over the three or four completed test matches in the series.
I just want to pick up on one point about those young test batters, and I want to just refer back to the career of Steve Waugh. So he made his debut 26 December 1985, took 4 years to make his first test 100, almost 40 innings. His first 10 test innings, he passed 13 once. The Australian selectors at that time had no choice but to stick with Steve Waugh. They had very few other players, so they had kind of had to stick with him for a little while. But they persevered with him without scoring a test 100. He showed lots of promise, like Crawley have, like Pope has, like Lawrence has, like Burns has, for several years before they went, you know what, actually, we might try his brother. What I haven't seen from the England selectors yet is the persistence to try those guys. If they think Zach Crawley is the man for the job for 10 years for England, they need to give him 2 or 3 years in the post. And maybe they've given him long enough. Maybe I'm kind of alone here on the Zach Crawley mountain, but it feels to me like they've given those guys just enough to fail frequently without giving them a chance to succeed frequently. And that only comes with an extended time in the middle to figure out your game. Sometimes that works if you can play a lot of domestic four-day cricket in between your test matches. But when you're not playing enough four-day domestic cricket, the only time you can learn to be a test cricketer is by being a test cricketer. So if you're going to marginalise the four-day game as England have and as Australia have too, to the point in Sheffield Shield, then you kind of have to stick with those guys who you think have got talent to see you through. I don't think it serves England cricket very well long-term to go back to Dawid Malan, to go back to James Vince, to go back to Johnny Bairstow. They are still fine, fine cricketers, and there's no disrespect there to say that Johnny Bairstow, I love watching him play. He's one of my favourite test cricketers, one of my favourite all-format cricketers. But for England to move forward in 4 or 5 years, is Johnny Bairstow going to be in that test side? Maybe not. But someone like Zach Crawley, Dan Lawrence, Ollie Pope, they are likely to form the nucleus of that test side in 4 or 5 years. So they need to be given the right support in order to be able to succeed. They've been given enough rope to fail in succession and then get dropped, but for mine, not enough to succeed often enough in the right kinds of scenarios. But maybe I'm alone on Zach Crawley mountain in that case.
Yeah, for me, with Crawley and Lawrence, I guess I'm not going to beat up on them too much, but I don't think they've shown the skills capable to play international cricket at this time. Ollie Pope, even though he hasn't had a massive amount of success, I think that there is a lot of promise there with him, and we're starting to see that come out now, hopefully. I guess when you look at guys like Folks, he got a chance in going to the subcontinent, and he kept really, really well. Batting was very hard in the subcontinent, but he did an all right job. I guess my main takeaway from this series is around how I wanted to see the Indian batsmen up against the English bowlers. Unfortunately, the English bowlers didn't quite make it throughout the whole series. The injuries, and they fell over. And on the other side of that, the Indian batsmen did show up. They were available, but they didn't. They fell over as well, especially in the middle order. So for me, that feels a very unfulfilled. For me, I was looking forward to this 5-match series to see that. But I'll echo your comments on Rohit Sharma. I think KL Rahul as well showed a lot of promise as an opening batsman for India, which none of us thought that he would fill that role before the series at all. I think that England actually has a lot to take away from that series from a positive note. When they get people back like Jofra Archer, like Stuart Broad, or even Ben Stokes, when they get these people back, I see them actually being really competitive on the world stage. The test now is to go to Australia and not embarrass yourselves, because very, very good teams have gone to Australia and played really, really poorly. So it'll be interesting to see what happens as we go through the motions over the next 2 months to who's going to tour. I'm hopefully crossing my fingers that we'll have a good Ashes series down under.
Yeah, I'm hopeful of that as well. I mean, the only guy that I would add to that list of guys that have been shining lights for England in this English summer is Chris Wokes. I think he just showed his quality again as a tremendous cricketer. We talked about him in the wrap-up of the fourth test, but he's one of those guys that I think will come to Australia and will bat with purpose. He'll make a few runs at the bottom of the order. He'll, you know, he'll just do enough with the ball. I know he's not express pace, and people talk about you needing to have express pace in Australia. McGrath didn't, you know, Rifle didn't, Stuart Clarke didn't. Those guys all were there or thereabouts, nibbled the ball about just half a bat length like Chris Wokes does. And I think he's going to be a key for England in that Down Under tour, even if they take Wood and Archer and Stokes and Anderson and Broad. I think Chris Wokes is going to be one of the keys for England in that series.
And yeah, just before we move on, Alistair Cook scored 100 today for Essex. So he might be dusting off the passport and getting the vaccinations done.
Still got it.
Well, guys, we've done that segment to absolute death. So we will be back after the swish to talk about Australia, Afghanistan, Black Caps in Bangladesh, and a whole host more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the pod. Look, far be it from us to delve into politics and cricket, but Australia, Afghanistan, looking like it may be another series that's cancelled in the very, very near future. Border, you've been keeping, I think, half an eye on that. Really tough for the players and got a feel for the Afghanistani cricketers. But yeah, how do we see this playing out over the course of the next few days?
Well, I think Cricket Australia's made their position quite clear that they're not prepared to host Afghanistan this summer. A real shame for the players and also for the fans as well. You know, the test was originally scheduled for my hometown to happen in August. That hasn't happened. It was then rescheduled to be played in Hobart, a venue that doesn't get very much test cricket at all. That's then been cancelled. So really for me, both for the Afghanistan players to participate in another test, which has been which will be very disappointing for them, and also for the Australian public not to be able to see Rashid Khan, you know, Mujibur Rahman, these kind of guys, Kaiz Ahmed, who've come down and played in BBL cricket and been, you know, crowd favourites, fan favourites down under, not being able to see them roll out for their country and put on their cap and play Australia in tests, I think will be a great disappointment both to the players, I should say, and also to the fans as well.
Yeah, look, and I think it's another one where it's a let's see what happens in the next 6 months. And, you know, I mean, are they going to be in the T20 World Cup? Like, I feel like that's a question that nobody really knows. I mean, there's been nothing kind of said that about that. There's the ICC guidelines. I think I read something that, you know, they had 5 years to kind of sort out a women's team to sort of be a qualified test nation. That hasn't really happened to the best of my knowledge. I mean, I think there are a few ripple effects here that, yeah, sadly for those Afghanistani players, it could mean, you know, yeah, could mean that they're just gone completely. It's going to be really tough.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a new situation. You know, we've had, you know, nations like South Africa where there's instability in the country. They're not an ICC full member anymore. So, I mean, there's no way any team can tour there. There's even questions around touring the northern parts of Pakistan as well because it's so close to Kabul. So I think that we just need to sort of get to that point now where we understand that they're unfortunately not going to be able to play with this destabilization that's going on, and let's move forward.
Well, on that note, let's move forward. We were talking on the last pod just how impressive Tom Latham was as captain, keeper and batter for the Black Caps. Proved us all right in that final match of the five-match series, player of the match for a well-compiled 50. But Bangladesh getting over the line in the five-match T20 series, 3-2. We asked this right at the really at the start after the first couple of games. What have we learned? What's the experience been like for the players? And I guess Bangladesh taking any confidence having ambushed New Zealand on some pretty spin friendly and slow wickets out there.
I think we learned that they can actually prepare decent wickets in Bangladesh. If anyone watched that fifth T20, the pitch was quite different. I don't know what really happened there. That was quite curious, but you know, proved to be a much more entertaining game, and one New Zealand played really well. And I thought so. You know, I guess that's the first takeaway. But you know, I've been thinking a lot about the value of this series and you know what it means. And I asked the question on Facebook and got quite a lot of engagement and some really interesting answers. And I think one of the things that a few people picked up on really was around that it's going to hopefully be really good learning for the test players and a good experience for them to be over there in those conditions that potentially we will get similar-ish conditions in India when we go there in November and December and play two tests there. And, you know, I know you're not really supposed to be using your T20 games as preparations for your tests, but I think getting in that environment certainly helps them. And I think we've also learned a lot about some of those players, just the ability to, you mentioned Tom Latham, we've seen Ajaz Patel. I think we've just learned once again that they are good cricketers and they have value in whichever format of the game that we're talking about.
Yeah, for me, like I said in the pod last week, I didn't learn much from this. I mean, if you look at people like Rachit Ravindra, he probably heard a little bit, if not from a selection point of view, from a confidence point of view. He didn't bat well on those surfaces in general, struggled a little bit on that final one where the ball was zipping through a little bit. But in my opinion, he's our red ball specialist opener of the future who can play some white ball cricket if required. But I don't think he's going to eclipse people like the likes of Martin Guptill or Finn Allen when it comes to white ball cricket or Devin Conway. Finn Allen. Good segue there. He looked really good in that final game. Him and Guppy need to bat together ASAP. I want to see what those guys can do together as a combo. And Tom Latham, again, all class with the bat in that last 2020 there. But we all knew this. We knew this. This is not anything new to me. Overall, losing the series, being bowled out for less than 100 twice is not a good look. But I do think our efforts with the ball into the field were really promising and we competed even when we were bowled out for small numbers. Just one major point that I want to take away from this series, and that is, and also the Australian series that came before us in Bangladesh, is that bat is king in 2020 cricket, that format. And if we see pitches like this in the UAE, which is very possible coming up, the Asian teams are really going to, the ones who can grind out an innings with the bat, they're going to have a massive, massive advantage in that World Cup come November.
Just a quick question for you, Raj and Lippy. Did anybody that wasn't on the plane for this T20 World Cup get their business class seat reserved for that T20 World Cup from this little tour?
I was going to say, I'm surprised that Finn Allen's not there. So I assume that they're going to be using Devin Conway in that position, opening the batting. But Finn Allen, he's just a devastating batsman. I think he's got a big future in the Black Caps going forward.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think I said it last week. I think it's an unfortunate circumstance of COVID that these games really could never have been a trial for that World Cup, and it's a shame that they're not, because I think we would have seen that kind of battle where, you know, there's been a lot going around about why isn't Ajaz there? You know, he was just tremendous in this series, and you know, I think he probably, on what we've seen so far, looks like he could be incredibly useful as our potentially third spinner in that T20 lineup. However, then you think about, is he going to unseat Ish Sodhi, who was player of the series, I think, in New Zealand when we played the T20 series against Australia? Mitchell Santner has been one of our best white ball players for a long, long time. So, you know, I think, and even Todd Astle, who is the one player that everyone's kind of going, well, why is Todd there ahead of Ajaz? Well, Todd Astle played against Bangladesh in the last series and got four in his last time he bowled. So, you know, it's tricky. It's a hard one. And I don't, you know, Ajaz has done brilliantly well, but I think we're going to see now Todd play, and then we're going to see how well that goes. If, you know, if Todd doesn't go that well in Pakistan, maybe everyone's going to be still going, look, Ajaz should be on that plane. But if Todd performs well, then perhaps we're not even talking about this. And I think we have to also consider that Ajaz had played, I think, three T20s for New Zealand, or even maybe even two or something before that. He hadn't hardly played a T20 game. I don't know if he's played an ODI for New Zealand. So, you know, he hadn't really been in that consideration. Whether that matters or not, and whether the selectors should have seen that, who knows? But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's tough, and it's sort of the same with Finn Allen, because I think that I completely agree. He's if he can figure out the balance between risk and reward in the way he plays his cricket shots, which I, you know, he's 22 years old. I think he'll get there. He's going to be some player for us in that white ball format, because I don't know. I mean, just some of the shots that he played, even on those surfaces, he reverse swept, but it was more like a reverse pull for six. You know, just some tremendous cricket shots. And, you know, I think that you're right, Raj, that they'll go with Guptill and Conway, and they probably see Seifert in there as someone who could open if that pairing, if they don't want to go with that pairing. I actually think they'll go with Seifert as kind of their closer, but, you know, Seifert's in that mix to open, and they probably just went, look, we're just going to go with other options at the moment. And Finn's been great, but, you know, he's young, and these other guys have been proven so far, but I don't know. We'll see in a few weeks whether that's proved right. Raj, you're going to get your opportunity to see Guptill and Finn Allen play over the next, you know, the next few games in Pakistan, because Guppy's about to join the squad for those last five T20s over there.
So from one captain's knock to another, Heather Knight getting England's women over the line in a pretty good series, actually, against the White Ferns. So what do we take from, yeah, what do we take from that?
Well, you just grab your phone there, Binksy. But I think we take, it's probably, I don't know that I've got a huge amount more to add than what I said last week, because I think from a White Ferns perspective, they'll be disappointed that they lost that game. I mean, it was a really nail-biting game. Came down to the last over. It looked for a second there that Amy Satterthwaite was going to get New Zealand home. But then, you know, unfortunately, after bowling really well, bowled a full toss, and Sophia Dunkley just hit it through mid-wicket for four, and that was the game. But, you know, I think that they've played some good cricket there, and they've really shown that they can compete against England, which is sort of all we wanted at this point. Whether it's going to translate to the ODIs, I guess, because, you know, we're building now towards the ODI World Cup. You know, whether they can continue that over the 50-over format is going to be another question. I certainly hope so. But, you know, we'll see on Friday. And, yeah, it's, I think we just want to continue that and make sure that the big players for New Zealand are the ones stepping up, because if we can get Devine, we can get Bates, we can get Satterthwaite, And the Kerr sisters, you know, assuming that Amelia Kerr is back for that series, Leah Tahuhu, you know, there are genuine match winners in that New Zealand side. And if we can get them all performing at the right time, we're a chance. And that's all you want.
Well, boys, we'll move on to a little bit more T20 cricket. Apologies for the interruption in the background. It was a withheld number, so it was either the Taliban or the BCCI trying to track me down for my comments on the podcast. So I've just thrown that burner phone away. Let's talk about the IPL restart. Keeping tabs a little bit on the player movement. We didn't mention actually in the England-India segment, I don't think a number of England players pulling out of the IPL at fairly late stages. I've got to be honest, I don't think that's got anything to do with any sort of tit for tat. I think it is more a case of those guys wanting to be ready for the Ashes if they're selected. I think Johnny Bairstow in that group that's kind of pulled pin, and Wokes as well with a young family. Now he's back in that England setup. I think probably just wanting to take that break. But yeah, are we pumped for this tournament and the resumption of it, or are we sort of a little bit sort of still feeling a bit of trepidation about how it's all going to play out? There's a bit of water to go under a few bridges, I'd imagine, before we know the full makeup all of these squads, I think.
Yeah, that's what's going to be the interesting thing for me. I'm actually looking forward to seeing what these squads actually end up looking like the day of the first game. There's so much that could happen between now and the start of the IPL, which is less than a week away, that could completely change the fortunes of some of these teams. if you have a look at it on paper, these teams have changed markedly between when we paused the IPL back in March and even to now. Guys like Chris Wokes coming in and out, you know, Pat Cummins coming out and Tim Southee coming in for KKR is a bit of a like-for-like. But some of the players who've chopped and changed haven't been like-for-like replacements. So the balances of the some of the squads have changed. And, you know, if you have a look at the Royals with Stokes being unavailable or Archer or Butler or whoever, you know, some of the kind of dynamics of those teams are going to change markedly as well. So plenty of opportunity for some players who are coming in, and it's going to be like, I don't know who's going to win this tournament. I've got no idea now who's going to come back and perform well, because there's just been so much upheaval and change in some of these sides.
I can tell you that I'm not especially excited about this. I'm not someone that's been super excited about the IPL at all at times, but I can definitely say that the last couple of years I've you know, probably because I've been on, you know, we've been doing this podcast, but also just been it's been played at times when it's had its window, right? And now it just feels like it does not have a window now, and it's going to be packed in. I'm certainly more interested in both the New Zealand series that are going on, and all I'll be really doing in the IPL is monitoring those New Zealand players, monitoring how Glenn Phillips is going. And I'm actually pretty excited with, you know, what he's been able to do. He's had a sort of weird kind of CPL in terms of he's played a couple of really cracking innings, played an 80, scored 80 not out overnight here in New Zealand, you know, recording this on a Monday night. And, you know, but he's had a lot of failures. And I think I always hark back now to what Colin Munro said when he talked to us about how basically your job, certainly at the top of the order in a T20 series and T20 tournament, is to go ahead and play three or four match winning innings in your 10 innings. And it, you know, anything else above that is kind of a bonus. And that's how I see Phillips kind of playing. Although when you come to a T20 World Cup, you don't have 10 games, you know, you've only got three or four games in the pool play, and then it's just knockout. So, you know, he's going to have to fire in a couple of those games potentially for us to get across the line. But yeah, in terms of actually who I think will win the tournament, Mumbai and Delhi to me still feel like they were the top sides before, and they're probably still the top sides now, because primarily because of their Indian players, and particularly Delhi, just, you know, their Indian core of players, which we've been talking about for a few years now, is all still there. And it doesn't really matter if these the international players come and go. The really important players for them are still going to be there. And I think that kind of remains the same for Mumbai as well, in terms of the Pandyas and Sharma and Kishan and Jasprit. So, look, yeah, I'd be hard-pressed to back against those two sides.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very interesting, actually. We've got teams that were picked for one time of year in one part of the world for being literally transported to another part of the world at a completely different time of year. So that'll be interesting. Also, I like what you were talking there about, Stu, when you were talking about the momentum of those teams. I think it's going to be interesting because those are the players who have been playing. I don't know when the last time those domestic Indian players played, but I don't think they've played white ball cricket in a very, very long time. So that's going to be very interesting to see who comes in form and with that momentum behind them. I personally am really looking forward to it. I really like watching the IPL. There is a small window there, which they managed to talk the Caribbean Premier League into, and the World Cup, between the World Cup. So it's kind of an appetizer for me for the World 2020, but I'm looking forward to it.
Well, that's an awesome segue into the World 2020. I guess on the IPL, I'll just write the Sunrisers off down the bottom of the table. Only a couple of points, so they might struggle to come back into it, but I think everyone else is still in touch. We're not going to go into all of the squads here, and you know, I think the reason I asked the question in the Black Cap segment is there is the ability to name some reserves, and these were only provisional squads for the World Cup. So I think we'll see some further dropouts and injuries, and perhaps the odd COVID test and some of those reserves entering the fray. But anyone got an eye on any of the particular goings on as these squads have started to come out over the last week or so?
Well, I just actually wanted to come to you first, Binksy. The England squad's been named. A couple of interesting names there. A couple of names that you're big fans of, and one or two that you're not so big fans of. What did you make of that England squad that's been named for this T20 World Cup?
Yeah, so I think the biggest surprise in the squad for anyone that's been watching English white ball cricket over the course of the last couple of years will be the return of Tamal Mills, who's had a very, very good 100 tournament. So for those of you who don't know him, picked up a pretty decent paycheck three or four IPLs ago. Bowls really good gas, left arm pace above 90 mile an hour, but then also has a number of slower balls where he dips into the sort of 60 mile an hour with no sort of perceptible change to his action. Perhaps shouldn't be a surprise because Owen Morgan was talking him up quite heavily during that 100 competition and saying he might be a little bit of a bolter for this tournament. And not surprising for me, but certainly someone that I wouldn't have picked would have been Sam Billings. Averages somewhere, look, around about 20, I think, with the bat. Wouldn't be in the top 10 wicket keepers either. So I think there's a couple of guys on the outer of that squad that have been in and around as well. James Vince has had a very good domestic season for Hampshire, a very, very good big bash season last year for the Sydney team that plays in pink. I never get it right, whether that's the Sixers or the Sixers, Thunder.
Yep.
And then I think the other one is Tom Banton, who, you know, can wear the gloves and gives it a bit of a lick as well. So that's the surprise for me. But I'm really excited. Probably the one that I'm looking out for is Liam Livingstone, who had a fantastic 100 tournament. And I've just got a sneaky feeling that this tournament might actually see him make his way into that red ball side as well to fill one of those problem middle order slots for England a little bit later on. Who knows, even the Ashes, perhaps.
He might have to bowl as well because they've only picked two spinners, haven't they, really? They've picked Ali and Adil Rashid, you know, no other spinner. So Livingstone might have to do a job there. But yeah, he's certainly right. He had an awesome 100.
And guys, what else have we got our eyes on? I think we've got Faf du Plessis being left out of the South Africa squad and very pointed to say that was left out of the squad in the commentary there.
Yeah, look, from what I'm reading, you know, I think it certainly comes as a surprise to us that aren't really, you know, following South African cricket as intently as people who are in the country and big fans of the side. You know, you see Faf in all the T20 tournaments and certainly performing well and think of him as someone that can, I certainly think he's someone that could be doing a job for them at the top of the order. But, you know, the line appears to be that they've pretty much just decided to stick with players who are in the contracted setup, and you know, that seems to be the case with someone like Imran Tahir, who you know how much I love him and his celebrations, and similarly with Chris Morris, as Binksy does a lap of his living room or his office there with the arms spread wide. But you know, yeah, it seems to be not a surprise that Tahir, Morris, and du Plessis are not selected, although, you know, to me, looking at that squad, I feel like they could be adding value.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I'm going to move on to the West Indian squad here, if that's all right with you fellas. The big elephant in the room for me is Jason Holder being left out, which is incredible for me. I'm really surprised. He's one of the better IPL players, one of the better players for the West Indies. And he has got an IPL contract, but he can't make their World Cup squad. And the other thing is the sort of makeup they've gone with, a heavy reliance there on all-rounders. So they've only picked four specialist bowlers, leaving out Sheldon Cottrell. So they're a massive reliance on the likes of Pollard, Bravo, Russell, and Fabian Allen to play a big part with the ball. So that's really interesting. And the last point I wanted to make, because I have watched a bit of the CPL, Sherfane Rutherford has been going really well. He's been looked really dominant in a number of innings, but he was left out and left out on a fitness standard that he couldn't keep up to, which I find interesting. And I'm happy to see that those standards are being put in place and being adhered to by the selection team. So, that's for me, West Indies.
A couple of interesting ones. I mean, Roston Chase was included, and also Ravi Rampal for a while. He hasn't played since 2015. But interestingly, that Cottrell and Jason Holder, guys that I would have expected to be named, have been left out. So a few interesting selections in that West Indies side. And also sort of Carlos Braithwaite not picked as well. So lots of interesting selections in that West Indies side. Can I talk about the Indian side? Because that's intriguing me big time. This Indian T20 squad, the first thing that I look at and I see that Indian squad is that Virat Kohli looks like he's going to open the batting, because they've only picked Rohit and KL Rahul as other opening options. No Shubman Gill, no Mayank Agarwal, no Prithvi Shaw, no Shikhar Dhawan. So staples of successful IPL sides at the top of the order, none of those have been picked in that side. So it looks to me like some combination of Kohli, Rohit Sharma and KL Rahul will open the batting in that Indian side moving forward. Wicket-keeping is also another interesting one. So obviously Rishabh Pant has been selected as their primary wicket-keeper. Mumbai's Ishan Kishan has also been selected as well. But no room for Sanju Samson. So there's some interesting sort of backup wicket-keeping options that they've got in there as well. No Shreyas Iyer as a pure batsman in that lineup. So their middle order is going to be probably Hardik Pandya, Pant, maybe Suryakumar Yadav as well. So there's lots of interesting kind of little niche kind of balance things in that Indian side. And of course, we'll open the mic up. Abhinkshu, you want to come in, and then we'll open it up to Shu to talk spin.
Yeah, so the Ishan Kishan pick caught my eye as well in that Indian squad. And certainly on the list that I've seen, he's got the little W next to his name as the second wicketkeeper in that squad, presumably after Pant. And I've just got maybe a sneaky suspicion, because he has been at the top of the order on occasion for the Mumbai Indians. Is he a bolter maybe? And he's actually not necessarily there for his keeping, although he can obviously do the job. You've got KL Rahul in the side as well. Whether or not potentially you could see Kishan at the top of the order with either Rohit or Virat potentially. So yeah, that might be just one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, officially he's been picked as the third opening option in this article I'm reading, but I read into this that Virat Kohli's probably going to open the batting, I think. That's the way. I mean, he's come out and said that he wants to do it. So if you've not picked Gill, you've not picked Agarwal, you've not picked Shaw or Dhawan, I think it's probably a pretty strong indicator that Virat's going to be at the top of that order. And then you've got, you know, Yadav Pant, Kishan, Pandya, Jadeja, all those kind of guys coming in after him.
Yeah, with the Ishan Kishan thing, I don't think he's been selected to open. You're not replacing Shikhar Dhawan with Kishan there. I think as we saw when India left Australia at the end of their tour, Virat Kohli was elevated up the order there. And in the IPL, he was opening the batting with an eye on this World Cup. So I would fully expect Virat Kohli and Rohit Sharma to open there. I do find the leaving out of people like Shikhar Dhawan very interesting. I thought they would be at home in those sort of conditions, and we've seen how devastating they've been in the white ball format for India and at the IPL level as well. But yeah, over to the spin corner, Stu.
Oh, look, you know, yeah, give me any opportunity to talk Ravi Ashwin. I did. It was ridiculous. I saw. I was scanning Twitter trying to find out any team news on the night of on that England-India game, and Ashwin was actually named. The news had all come out that he was going to play, that Ravi Jadeja had an injury, which is sort of weird, if we're going down that conspiracy line that they didn't think they were playing in the first place. Why did India kind of name, or why did it leak out that Ashwin was playing? But you know, obviously
it was all a dream, Lippy.
Maybe it was. It certainly extreme lengths to cancel the test just so that Ravi Ashwin doesn't play, isn't it? It's taking it to another level just to not get him in the side. But, you know, look, he's a tremendous bowler. You know, probably the biggest thing that stood out to me when you were naming all those guys, Baldy, is what an amazing squad of T20 cricketers that they have in India. And, you know, I know we've talked about it a lot around that, how the IPL has kind of just, it's built their depth in T20 cricket just to an unbelievable level. And, you know, when you're leaving out guys like Sanju Sampson and all of that stuff. And I think if you look through the lineup, certainly when I look through the New Zealand lineup with a critical eye, there's always kind of one or two gaps where I think, oh, you know, I just don't quite know if we're, you know, we've got, if these kind of guys fail, then do we have enough to kind of get across the line? Whereas you look up and down that Indian order and I just think, wow, what an amazing side. And they've got all those spinners. They didn't even pick Yuzvendra Chahal, who has struggled a little bit. And I think, you know, that probably on balance, I think that's kind of fair enough, even though he's been an established player for a long time. I think he hasn't really put the numbers together in recent times as much as he might have liked. But certainly from a viewing point of view, he's another player that I love watching. He, you know, tries to get wickets, which I love. And he seems like the kind of guy who's pretty fun to have around. So, yeah, disappointing not to have in that squad.
The interesting thing for me in the makeup of this bowling attack, so they've picked Jadeja, they've picked Rahul Chahar, they've picked R. Ashwin, Akshar Patel and Varun Chakravarthy. So they've picked effectively five spin bowlers in that squad. They've only picked three out-and-out pace bowlers. I mean, I know they've got Hardik Pandya, who may or may not bowl a few overs, but they've got Jasprit, they've got Bhuvi Kumar, and they've got Mohammad Shami. So no T. Natarajan, no Shardul Thakur, no Deepak Chahar. They feel a little bit light on, if anywhere, in that pace bowling department. They clearly think that it's going to be a turning wickets, a slow wicket tournament. But if you have a look, 12 months ago, IPL in the UAE, top wicket takers, Trent Bolt was right up there. Kagiso Rabada was right up there. The pace bowlers did a lot of damage this time 12 months ago in that tournament, and we didn't really see spin dominate. Now, maybe it's going to be different this time around. Maybe the conditions are subtly different. Maybe, clearly, they know something I don't. But I'm just a little bit perplexed that maybe they've missed a trick there in taking five spinners and only three medium paces.
Time will tell with all of those predictions on both the T20 World Cup squads, the resumption of the IPL, and, of course, plenty more cricket going on with the Black Caps. Just about to start their one-dayers against Pakistan. We will be back on the Top Order podcast to talk news, views and cricketing interviews next week. We're also eagerly awaiting our next Hall of Fame episode, where we're going to get to debate some wicketkeepers, which will be good fun for me after the last 5 weeks, just concentrating almost solely on off-spin. But for all of us here at the Top Order podcast, it's good night and God bless from us here in Auckland. We'll speak to you soon. Good night.
Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.